Lowe's knows that more projects mean more tools. For a limited time, new and existing MyLowe's Rewards credit card members can get 12-month special financing on purchases of $299 or more, in-store and online. Don't wait to get the things you need. Get special financing today. Lowe's. We help. You save. Now through August 27th, choose 12-month special financing on purchases of $299 or more. Offer subject to credit approval and cannot be combined. Minimum monthly payments required. See store or Lowe's.com for details.
Hi, I'm Luke.
And I'm Brennan.
We are the Farm Finders. When we first got married, we dreamed of owning land and building a self-sufficient lifestyle.
But we soon saw that buying land was almost out of reach. Land was expensive and hard to finance. But we couldn't just give up on our dream of being landowners.
To be honest, it was a pretty discouraging problem. But we were determined to find a solution. So we started a company called The Farm Finders to find properties that anyone could afford.
That was a few years back. And today, we're proud to say we've helped hundreds of people make their landowning dreams a reality.
There's something inside each of us that wants a piece of land to call our own. Here at The Farm Finders, we can make that happen.
If you're like us and dream of owning land, then check out our website at thefarmfinders.com to find that perfect property.
Take advantage of our no-credit check, zero-interest owner financing with payments as low as $50 a month with our secure online checkout. It's easy to make any property yours with just a few clicks.
So don't just dream. Do something. Visit thefarmfinders.com today.
Let's make you a landowner.
Now you can hear us around the world, streaming 24/7 at safetyfm.com.
Streaming live from Taos, New Mexico.
Here is Dr. Jay Allen on Safety FM.
Broadcasting live from the Safety FM studios in Orlando, Florida. Here is your host, Dr. Jay Allen on Safety FM.
This episode of the broadcast and the podcast is brought to you by Safety Focus Moments. They're consultants that want to help you get the safety culture you've been looking for. For more information, go to safetyfocusmoment.com.
Hello and welcome to Safety FM. This is Jay Allen. Hopefully everything is going fine for you this week. For a very long period of time, I have asked myself the question, where did human performance, human and organizational performance, or safety differently all come from? I knew that I was in love with this versionality of safety, but I really didn't understand everything about it. I didn't understand who all was involved. Are we following the process that the founding fathers had in mind when they created human and organizational performance? If it was coming from the Department of Energy, my assumption was always that it needed to be free. And I felt that we got to the point as an industry where we were not giving this information out for free anymore. I felt that there was a lot of consultants, instructors going out there and charging people for giving this information out there. So I wanted to know from the founding fathers if we were doing it correctly. I wanted to know from the founding fathers if it was still taking the same trajectory that they wanted when they originally put this together. As I did research, there was names that kept on coming up. And I was wondering, if I reached out to these people directly, would they be interested in telling me how it all occurred? And fortunately for us, they all have agreed to come on. So we're going to go down this journey on how human and organizational performance all started. I have sat here and contemplated how we're going to do this. I don't know if this is going to be a mixture of several different interviews together into one, if this is going to be just one interview after another on how the Department of Energy and INPO put this thing together. I don't know. And the funny part is that we record these intros before we start actually editing the audio clips together when we do a produced version of the podcast. So let's go down this journey together. We're going to have some people come on that we've heard of, but have not been in an interview standpoint on how it all started. So I hope that by the end of this interview mini-series with all these individuals, you're able to make a determination if we're doing the correct thing. Enjoy this mini-series on Safety FM.
It begins in Orlando, Florida, and travels steadily to the west, beaming across North America and planet Earth.
And into your head.
The world of safety never stops. And now, the Safety FM podcast and broadcast with Dr. Jay Allen.
Shane Bush.
How did you get involved with the whole Department of Energy?
Yeah, and that might be the best place to start. So actually, what happened was I had been working for a contractor for Department of Energy at the Idaho National Lab for some time. And in 2001, we had just achieved what's called STAR status with a safety program called the Voluntary Protection Program. And that's a big deal, but it requires continuous improvement. So my management challenged me immediately to go out and find what's the next big move in safety, what's the latest and greatest. And so there was three of us that were given the assignment, and we went out and benchmarked the traditional names like DuPont and others. But one organization that we really felt, and by the way, I need to qualify that a little bit, they were particularly interested in human error, or the fact that people were making mistakes at work and we were repeating these errors and mistakes. And so while they certainly wanted it to be safety overall, they kind of narrowed it to maybe there's something out there to deal with all these errors we're experiencing. So as we benchmarked, we came upon an organization called INPO, I-N-P-O, which is the Institute of Nuclear Power Operations. And they're a nonprofit organization primarily funded by commercial nuclear power plants. But we ended up attending one of their courses on how to manage human error. And if anybody's tracked commercial nuclear power plants, they've got an incredible run record as far as events versus output, and they've done nothing but continually improved in their output, and the cost of the kilowatt hour coming out of them has continually dropped. Safety's always gotten better. So it was very intriguing. So that's where we started, and we took their materials, which were all copyrighted at the time, and talked DOE into a contract with INPO that would allow us to take it and teach it at all of our DOE sites. And so we did. So we lucked out because they'd already formatted and done the studies on human error and human fallibility. And that's when I met Earl Carnes. And Earl Carnes was the DOE headquarters representative of improvement processes. So in 2001, 2002, early 2002, I happened upon Earl. And at first, it was just an introductory thing at a meeting conference. But as we had more and more success with this at the Idaho National Lab, it started getting the attention of other labs. If people are not familiar, DOE has numerous labs across the country, from New York to California, all over. And so he called and asked if I would come back to D.C. and meet with him, and did. And we kind of presented what we'd accomplished or what we'd attempted to do here in Idaho, and they wanted it repeated. So that's where Earl and I, and actually Todd was a real early start in this as well. I remember introducing Todd to this in 2002 or 2003, and he immediately came aboard. And so him and I and Earl ran around the DOE complexes just presenting this philosophy, because human performance is really a philosophy. Now, it has a methodology to it, but, and honestly, that's how it started. So we started running around, and Todd and I, probably in the funnest 2 years I can remember in facilitating courses was with Todd. That guy is incredible to facilitate with. But anyway, we ran around and got a lot of people on board and had some success with it. And then I started getting requests outside of DOE, which is a kind of a conflict of interest for me to do in some cases, because some of the customers were doing work for DOE, but in other cases not. So in about 2005, I decided to go on my own and actually went on a 3-year sabbatical from the DOE world and started my little consulting business. My wife and I did, by the way. And then it really took off, because it was about that time frame. I was primarily doing, because it was copyrighted material, people that were related to DOE or who could use it, like commercial nuclear power plants. But then all of a sudden DOE decided to put out a human performance manual, and which makes it all, as far as the public, makes it all available to anybody, because it's now considered general information. I can't remember the term for it right now, but there you go, public domain. And so then my world really opened up. In fact, I can remember getting a copy of the DOE manual in June from Earl Carnes with a little sticky note on it saying Merry Christmas. And I knew exactly what he meant, because all of a sudden then I could go to the Chevrons and the BP Oils and Schwan Foods and Disney World, and we could just start presenting this to anybody and everybody, because it was public domain. And that's probably the neatest thing about this. And Todd's the same way. But a lot of us, we give everything away that we've developed, because honestly, we just took what was already there and have created additional materials or given it our own spin. Or so the human performance world is pretty open with their materials. Now, there's some good products out there that you can buy. And if you're in the need of it, I certainly would encourage it. But the good news is you can get most of the introductory material just off the web. And so anybody can get into this with nothing more than downloading DOE's manuals. But it really took off. It was amazing. Todd and I, we've done work quite a bit together with Chevron. And in fact, we were hanging out in Bangkok last year, and him and my wife and I, and getting ready to go to Singapore to do a job. And we were just talking about, man, this has been such an amazing ride. Who would have thought these, as in Todd's words, country pumpkins or bunkins would end up out running around to, obviously, Singapore and Germany and Italy and all these different places. And Todd even does a lot more foreign work than I do. But so that was the beginning. Yeah.
Earl Carnes.
I guess really where we should probably start is, how did the path start for you?
It's like this. I want to put a couple of seeds down that will give you a clue about the path. And I mentioned to this to you a little bit before, Jay. And that is the idea that life is lived forward but understood only by looking backward. And you're probably familiar with that with Soren Kierkegaard. And the idea of indirect communication, that in the sciences, in technology, we're accustomed to direct communication, formal logic, the communication of facts. Kierkegaard and others, of course, said that, with the idea of indirect communication is that you can never, objectify what it is to be human. And as my friend, I don't know if you know Peter Hancock down at the University of Central Florida, but just an incredible person in engineering, human factors and all. And so we were together in Atlanta several years ago and laughing about the kind of stuff that we do. And he said, well, okay, like this, Earl. He said, they're the hard sciences. We all know the hard sciences. You're a chemist, I'm an engineer. And then they're the difficult sciences. The difficult sciences deal with people, and that's the really, really difficult stuff. So that's a context there. So thinking about those two kinds of things very early on, so I started off getting a degree in chemistry because it was kind of interesting. But in the meantime, I was doing studies in communication, and as you know, one of the social sciences, looking at psychology, philosophy, sociology, so forth, human communication, and wound up getting an offer when I was finishing up my undergrad from the communication department, the chair, who had been a professor of mine. He says, why don't you come back and get a master's degree? I said, well, I don't know, I'm thinking about X, Y, Z. He says, we'll pay for it. And I said, oh, that sounds like a good deal. So I did. And it was, and also along the lines there, was fortunate enough to get a research grant to do a research program on the alleviation of communication anxiety. So the point was, I was learning more about social sciences there on top of my chemistry degree. I had the opportunity to be introduced to the, social sciences research approach, through that grant and the mentoring that I got. I went over and did some studies in the psychology department associated with that to make sure I understood appropriate methodology and so forth. And this was in the time frame, too, that I was on a teaching assistantship. and working also with the University Debate Squad at the time that there was the national debate topic happened to be on nuclear power. Okay. I knew nothing about it, you know, really. But the utility in the state, which was Alabama Power, where Tony happened to be at one point in time, I'm a little bit older than he is, but anyway, they were starting a nuclear power project and started building a plant and had decided that a public education program, actually a broader education program on nuclear power, was something they needed to do. And so one of my professors had been hired as consulting for that, and they offered me a job, and that's how I got into the nuclear power game.
Very, very interesting how that works, specifically when you're saying that it was actually part of, it's interesting when you turned around and you said that it was part of the debate team, how it really starts, and then all of a sudden it takes a turn.
Right.
To this. This is very interesting. And I'm intrigued by the whole story so far. Let's continue down the path. So all of a sudden this happens. They offer you a job. How long are we talking timeline from being part of the debate team to job offer?
Well, actually, I was supporting coaching the debate team.
Oh, okay.
But when I, you know, as part of as the graduate faculty. Okay. But anyway. The timing was superb because the job was opening right as I was finishing my graduate degree, and not knowing what I wanted to do. So that made good sense, and I transitioned to that and learned a lot. And part of the point that I want to make, one of the big opportunities there is because of the significance, financial significance, and so forth, of the nuclear industry and the nuclear power plant, huge investment for the time. I, as a very young person, had the opportunity to work directly with the chief executives of the company. Okay, I would just, you know, if I'd been in engineering or something, I'd have been put down in the engineering department and, you know, may have never met the CEO, but as it was, you know, we would have dinner together, you know, business occasions, you know. I was just a young fellow, but was exposed to some very, very interesting people who had excellent educations. They had a very interesting perspective on business because the utility business at that time was very, very much out of the mode of we are public service. You know, not that our business is to make money. Of course, every business has to make money, but we are here because we are of a public service. So there was somewhat of a noblesse oblige, you know, attitude to the senior executives. And they were typically, you know, distinguished, very thoughtful engineers, attorneys, most of them with multiple degrees and all that kind of stuff. So it was the ability to start interacting at the senior level very early in my career that I became accustomed to, you know, interacting in an inappropriate way with people who thought strategically. So we have nuclear power, we have, you know, strategic influence, you know, social science, physical science, all that kind of stuff combined. And they trusted me enough that along came the TMI accident, Three Mile Island nuclear power plant accident in Pennsylvania. And so while I had been talking, you know, part of my job was to go out and work with influence leaders and educators and you know, state government and things like that to give them nuclear power 101, they entrusted me to be a principal spokesperson for the company, going on television a lot and explaining about nuclear power and the accident. Okay, so I was doing that kind of work, and it was shortly thereafter that in 1979, roughly in 1980s, in that point, that the Institute for Nuclear Power Operations was established.
Now, let me ask you a question real quick, and I pardon for me interrupting you. How far are you in the career before March 28th, 1979 occurs? So how long have you already been inside of the nuke industry?
Let's see. I joined the utility in 1982.
Todd Conklin.
Give or take right here. 2004, you decide to write Simple Revolutionary Acts. And we're talking June is what I can find, unless you tell me otherwise. The purpose at the time, what were you thinking about doing that you decided to move forward with this?
So that looks really interesting because I was working with Coca-Cola. And I was working full-time at Los Alamos. And then because Los Alamos is operated by the University of California, you could do this thing called a 701 form, which was a permission to do outside work. And it was a conflict of interest form, which those of people that listen to the podcast who've worked in any kind of government job totally know what that's about. And so I was doing this work with Coca-Cola, and we were working on reliability. We were really working on reliability from the safety and security side. And the director, his name was Bill McGrath, really good guy. And he said, you ought to write a book. And he said, if you write a book, we'd be interested we'll buy some. So I thought, well, I wonder what I should write a book about. Because at the time, I mean, this is kind of pre the New View stuff a little bit. And we're really just starting to dance around this notion of reliability, connected with psychological safety, connected with the culture of the organization. So I looked at a book and thought, well, it strikes me that what we're really wanting to do is, at the time, I was thinking revolutionize the workplace. But now if I had to do it, I'd probably say disrupt the workplace. But Revolutionary Acts is really based upon this notion of disruption. But it was kind of before the word disruption became a popular term to talk about it. And I had spent a bunch of time working with Edgar Schein on culture stuff, because he's kind of the dude for culture stuff. And he sort of led me to thinking about maybe writing the book so kind of one page represented a small revolutionary act you could do in the workplace that could happen at any level. It could happen at a leadership level. It could happen at the worker level. And it was relatively effective. It was kind of a fun book to write.
Now, at this particular time in your life, are you already doing the stuff with DOE? Are you already working on that program or not yet?
So we haven't started it yet in the DOE. It's still a little before that, but it's coming really soon. So it's going to be right around the corner pretty soon. But at that point in time, we're just starting to figure out that culture and a more holistic view has impact on really reliable performance. So we're looking a lot at safety and a lot of security. But in the DOE, safety and security are kind of similar. I mean, they're not, but they're sort of managed kind of the same way. It's been an interesting journey, because initially we managed both safety and security with programs directed at the worker. And that Simple Revolutionary Acts book is really the first time when we started looking away from the worker being the problem to maybe the worker being the solution.
So do you look back now and kind of realize that this is kind of like groundwork if you were looking full scheme on really getting into human and organizational performance as you're moving forward?
Yeah, totally. And it's funny too, because since you encouraged me to read that book on Audible, I was really surprised at how well that book held up over 15 years or 16 years, however old. It's pretty old. And I really, really see this as kind of some of the initial groundwork to begin to sort of prepare the soil to begin the organization in a conversation that's more holistic, more systems-based in nature. And it's funny, I don't think, at least I can only speak for myself, I don't think I would have been as prepared to move in the direction I moved around the safety stuff had I not spent some time thinking about the disruptive stuff that Simple Revolutionary Acts kind of represented.
Earl Carnes.
On the morning of March 28th, about 7 o'clock, sitting there with my coffee, looking out the window, and the phone rings. It is a reporter from a local radio station, and she says, "Hey, Earl, what's to do with this accident going on up in, you know, Pennsylvania?" And I didn't spit my coffee, but I might as well have it. I said, "Can you tell me more?" And she said, "Yeah, let me read you the AP." So she read me the AP, and I'm going, Three-Mile Island, dude, you know, I hadn't done a lot in the industry. So the Black and Beach had a directory of all the plants in the United States. I'm busily trying not to sound stupid. So I'm looking up Black and Beach, you know. Oh, okay. And I go, well, that's a boiling water reactor. Ours is a pressurized water reactor. So that, you know, went off to, oh, well, tell me the difference. So then I had something I could talk about. I pick up the phone. After that, I called the Atomic Industrial Forum and talked to Pat Bryant, who is the membership liaison. And I said, Pat, what's going on at 3 Mile Island? She said, what do you mean what's going on at 3 Mile? I just got a call, said there's an accident. She said, there's an accident. You know, this was the big group that represented nuclear power in the United States. I said, yeah, there's an accident. She said, let me call you right back. Well, it's been all these years. Pat never called me back. That's the way they found out about it.
So right now, when you get into INPO, is the focus now 3 Mile Island? Is that part of the reason they're bringing you in, or is this a separate reason starting off?
No. I mean, the reason INPO was founded, the catalyst for INPO being founded was 3 Mile Island. And before then, the utilities were geographical and corporate fiefdoms in a way, you know, by legislation and so forth. And you know how networked everything is today. It was not that way, you know, the transmission industry and so forth. So this was, it was unique for the time, and it's, you know, unique in the history of the nuclear technology and many technologies, that the industry bound together and they said, we can't afford for this to happen again, you know. And the phrase, I can see the guy's name, can't call his name anyway, hostages of each other. If you haven't read that, that's an excellent history of the nuclear power plant, the nuclear industry in the United States, and the formation of INPO. Because many people understand how a lot of people have industry proprietary information and their technologies and their secrets and so forth, so to speak, that are, you know, unique to them. And but the industry said, okay, you know, we may have certain proprietary interests, but we have got to band together and establish common standards that go beyond the regulations and make sure that we as an industry drive the performance of the entire industry so that there are no poor performers, and that we're constantly improving and striving every day to improve what we're doing. And that was the basic mission of Institute of Nuclear Power Operations, which was excellence. And when you go into the INPO headquarters, you know, in the nice big atrium area out there, there's standing right there, very visible to everyone, is a marble pillar. And carved into the surface on the top of the marble pillar is the word excellence, except with the final letters are not finished. So that was the idea. It's the pursuit of excellence because you never achieve it. So that was my introduction to INPO. And I'll finish that off. I'll give you a couple of things. The first things that they were doing, you know, were working with the industry on obvious things, being response to the recommendations that came out of the various investigations on the TMI accident. And some of them had to do with hardware, a lot of it had to do with training, some of it had to do with procedures and things like that. So the industry was still, you know, in the process of responding to those basic recommendations as INPO was getting started. So a lot of people they drew on from the nuclear Navy, because there was not a huge body of expertise within the commercial nuclear power industry such that utilities were willing to let a lot of their good people go, you know, and go to work in this. They had to have them there working in their plants, and so was the idea. So Dennis then started hiring people, good people from the nuclear Navy, and that was all an interesting story too. But I'll shift to this. So I had great fortune then, not immediately, but later, to be recruited to work with my dear friend and mentor, Jim Forsythe. Now, Jim crewed with Dennis on the maiden voyage of the Nautilus, okay? And he was a Navy captain. He was a good farm boy from Wisconsin. And so he was a plankover. He was one of the originals and was the first team leader that Dennis hired to start leading these teams going out doing the evaluation of the plants. And he had done with the Navy ORSPORT, which is the big evaluation group for Rickover that went all over the place evaluating nuclear subs. So he had a tremendous wealth of expertise there. And he and Dennis were incredible leaders. I mean, you know, if you're even a young guy like me who was not Navy and knew nothing, Dennis would stop by if I was, I usually would work beyond quote normal closing time when I was there doing something quiet. And so Dennis, I'd look up, Dennis would come and say, "Hey, what you doing, Earl?" And he'd sit down and he'd talk. But it wasn't just me. He would do that for everybody, okay? So he had that. He didn't have this command style. Everybody loved him. They'd do whatever Dennis wanted. But he had a way of working with people. Same thing with Jim. You know, his people just loved him. And these were very interesting, educated people, too. Jim was a certified gem cutter in the United States and the UK. Did beautiful gemstones. Taught me that art. He was a student of American history, in particular Western literature, and when he retired, he started an antique bookstore down in Florida. So these are interesting people. So the point being there to all this is that it was a way of thinking. Again, I had the great pleasure of being able to work for gentlemen like this, observing them. You know, it was not telling me what to do, but me studying that. And I remember saying, so Mr. Jim, and Jim, Director Jim, when Jim went to hire me, I said, "Well, Jim, I'm very flattered, but I said, I'm not an engineer." He said, "Earl, I can hire engineers." He said, "I can hire engineers. I need somebody who can help me think about organizations, basically, people." And so from my prior experiences, the way I went through all this kind of stuff, Jay, was that I've been fortunate enough to have these multiplicity of experiences and educational background and working in the education arena and being comfortable interacting with senior executives and things like that, that I guess maybe I had a skill set. Well, I know I had a skill set that, and research, I should say, too. I had a skill set that the engineers, we had the really, really very fine engineers, a lot of them out of the Navy, some utility, but they didn't have. And so they...
So they're pretty much looking at you right there at that particular standpoint as the translator.
Exactly.
You're being able to take the lingo from the engineers and go to, we'll call it the suite level, the upper management, and have these discussions where they might not be able to have the same linguistics that you do. Yeah,
that's correct. And there was another part of it. And this is very important for people to know, I believe, or at least it's the stories I tell myself, and that is that I knew that I didn't know anything about the nuclear technology like these people did. So, you see, every time that we go out on an evaluation, every team leader, these were high-powered people, would do an evaluation of all team members. Well, I never paid any real attention to this, because as long as Jim was happy, I was happy, you know. So one day this guy walks in the office, and he was really ticked off. And he was grousing about his evaluation. He didn't get the evaluation he thought he ought to have. And he said, "Well, what did you get?" And I didn't know that there was an envelope, you know, that stuck in my inbox. So I opened it up, and I had a very good evaluation. He was really ticked off. He said, "Look, I've been an engineer. I've been in this plant. I've been in that plant, all this kind of stuff. You don't have the experience. How come you get rated better than I do?" So I never had thought about it before, okay? And it came to me that I was comfortable with being ignorant, you know?
I guess that's one way to look at it differently.
But it wasn't important for me to think that I knew more than the people that I was evaluating. As a matter of fact, I went in presupposing that they knew more than I did, and I was genuinely interested.
Tune in next week as we continue the story of human and organizational performance, how it started, here on Safety FM.
The views and opinions expressed on this podcast are those of the host and its guest and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of the company. Examples of analysis discussed within this podcast are only examples. They should not be utilized in the real world as the only solution available, as they are based only on very limited and dated open source information. Assumptions made within this analysis are not reflective of the position of the company. No part of this podcast may be reproduced, stored in a retrieval system, or transmitted in any form or by any means, mechanical, electronic, recording, or otherwise, without prior written permission of the creator of the podcast, Jay Allen.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.